Jason Stearns is the author of a new book, Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa. He has worked on the conflict in the Congo for the past 10 years, including work for the United Nations and the International Crisis Group. Thanks very much for joining us, Jason.
Thank you.
Your new book, Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, is an attempt to get past some of the simplistic views of the conflict in DRC. But what do you think the cost has been of some of the misunderstanding of the causes of violence in DRC?
The cost has been huge, and my book is largely speaking a history of the conflict, talking in detail about the protagonists and the various people involved, and just try to provide a history of what happened, really. But the overarching, I think, analysis or the message of the book is that we need to respect and engage with the political complexities of the Congo. And not doing so will be at our folly and at the folly of the people of the Congo. And all too often in the Congolese conflict, what happened was, in the face of this tremendous complexity, and the Congolese conflict is an incredibly complex conflict, the two reactions of outside actors, in particular Western donors, has been either apathy and indifference. In other words, it's too complex. We can't understand it. Let's look away. Or which has been just as pernicious, you could argue, in getting involved in the wrong way. And in particular, picking winners, picking heroes in particular, where there are no heroes, or picking a side when really it's much more complex than that. So I think that and I can talk a little bit about exactly how that happened, but that I think is the overarching message of the book. So the beginning of the book, I start out talking about the various pathologies of perception in terms of the Congo, and then just the simplification of the conflict into, above all, into a conflict between savages and victims, between African warlords and their innocent victims, has produced these sorts of attitudes toward the conflict that have really done very little to bring an end to it, and sometimes even furthered it.
In terms of the complexity of the violence, we did a previous interview with Severine Odasser, and she argued that the reason why the violence has continued is because of misunderstanding about the root causes, which are often at the local level or the community level. Would you agree with that analysis?
I would agree with some of it and disagree with other parts of it. Severine's argument refers to the period after 2003, after the peace deal. And her argument is that the conflict had three layers. There was a regional, a national, and a local layer. And by 2003, the outside actors had primarily gotten involved to address the first two. In other words, the regional and the national players, because they engaged largely with the state actors and with the rebel groups, but they did not engage with to the same degree with local actors, customary chiefs in getting involved in resolving land conflicts and conflicts over local authority. And she argues that that's the primary reason. Now, I certainly believe that there has been a lack of understanding of conflict in general, and a lack of understanding of what drives conflict. And this has also characterized the other parts of the conflict from 1996, when the conflict first began. Where I would disagree is that I think that the primary cause for the continuation of the conflict since 2003 was not land conflict, was not conflict over local authority, but was a much more fundamentally political conflict over power and access to assets, economic, political, security interests in the Eastern Congo that very often were not local in the sense of the kind of local that she's talking about and customary chiefs and local land holdings, but were the main political elites in the Eastern Congo. And so I think we have, I think it's a more of a, when I talk to Severine, I disagree with her in terms of putting a more political spin on things. What happened in 2003 was, perhaps just to give a brief overview, there was a peace deal that brought all of the main belligerents in the Congo together into a transitional government. The main actor in the Eastern Congo, an armed group called the RCD Goma, that had controlled roughly a third of the country, the entire east of the country, one could say, They suffered dramatically during this transition. The transition led to elections, and the RCD went from controlling a third of the country to controlling only a few percent, 2 or 3% in elected institutions, because there were elections at the end of that transition. And as a reaction to that, the RCD Goma, political elites affiliated with it, political elites in neighboring Rwanda, they created a plan B. In other words, they weren't sure the democratic transition was going to work for them, was going to be able to protect their assets and interests, and therefore they invested in an armed group, namely the CNDP, which was the main insurgent armed group in the Eastern Congo after 2003. And it was fighting with the CNDP then that created drastic destabilization of the Eastern Congo between 2003 and 2010. And Severin doesn't really engage with that whole political aspect of things. So I think that's where our main differences probably lie.
Sure, that overview is very helpful. I wonder if you could go back in terms of other causes of the continued violence. There's a lot of international discussion and debate on the role of minerals and the mineral trade. I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit. I know you just said recently that you're cautiously optimistic about reforms in the mining sector and the impact they might have.
Sure. What's frustrating for me is that primarily now the Congolese conflict is seen through two lenses. One is sexual violence, and another is conflict minerals. And the consequence of this sort of interpretation of the conflict is that people see violence as a struggle by armed groups over natural resources, and in the process of which they rape a lot of women. Now, as a consequence, people sort of reduce these armed groups to apolitical actors, greedy actors, just trying to get access to minerals. When the reality of thing is that the conflict in the Eastern Congo that began in 1996 had very little to do with minerals, had almost nothing at the beginning to do with minerals. And getting rid of the nexus of minerals and conflicts, getting rid of the pernicious contribution of minerals to the conflict today is not going to bring an end to the conflict. Minerals are a resource to armed groups, just like anything else is a resource to armed groups. They tax the minerals trade, like they tax the palm oil trade, like they tax the cannabis trade, like they tax the timber and charcoal trade. It happens to be the largest resource, but for some armed groups, it's not the most important contributor to its finances. So I think that it's reduced the conflict in the Eastern Congo really to a caricature of itself. And therefore, while I think that it's very important to tackle corruption, to tackle impunity, and to tackle the contribution of natural resources to conflict, it's not the only thing. Natural resources are not the only thing contributing to conflict. Conflict in the Eastern Congo, as conflict anywhere, is about access to political power and access to resources. And that is a much more complicated story than just that. So this is why I'm frustrated. At the same time, I certainly back the initiatives to deal with conflict in the Eastern Congo, but I try to explain to people that it's a much larger story than just some minerals and mining. It's a story about politics, state collapse, state weakness, understanding the various actors, understanding what they're trying to get out of it, and that goes far beyond just mining.
Sure. Sure. There has recently been some moves to try and get fair trade certification for gold in South America, and that's possibly been suggested for DRC too. Might something like that, although it won't address the political causes of the violence, might it at least create some employment in the east of the DRC?
So after I, gave my little preamble there about why minerals is not everything in the conflict, I do support improvements of accountability and transparency in the minerals trade, simply because it is such a large part of the conflict economy. And in particular, because I think it also could be a good way of not only delinking minerals from armed groups, but it could also help reform Congolese state institutions. And that's one of the biggest problems in Eastern Congo today, the desperate weakness of almost all state institutions, from courts to police to army to tax revenue organizations. So And ideally speaking, the conflict minerals legislation that's been passed in the United States and the Dodd-Frank Act last year, what it will do, it will make trade, mineral trade, impossible in the Eastern Congo unless certain criteria are fulfilled with regard to the documentation and certification of supply chains for all minerals, including gold. Now, the documentation and certification of supply chain will be impossible unless there are some transparent and legitimate institutions to carry that out. You need boots on the ground, and you need Congolese institutions on the ground that are much more transparent and accountable than they are now. So this is a good way of creating actually incentives for local economic actors to try to actually do something that has not been in their incentive. I mean, they've been living in sort of complicity with these corrupt institutions for a very long time, having no interest to reform these institutions. Now you're creating by this legislation in the United States and elsewhere, you're potentially creating an incentive for local political and economic actors to reform those Congolese state institutions. And that would be a huge step forward. So this is a very long way of answering your question, which was about gold. But for gold, it's a very similar thing, except for gold, by its very nature, is a more difficult resource to get a handle on because it's very small. It's very easy to smuggle. Almost all of the golds, almost all of the minerals, period, in the Eastern Congo are produced artisanally, with a few exceptions. There are some multinational corporations involved in gold mining, but otherwise it's pick and shovel kind of stuff. And when you talk about pick and shovel kind of stuff, you know, they will find gold, they will wash the gold, they will, you know, produce 30, 40, 50 grams of it, stick in their pocket, and then walk across the border or walk to a town and then smuggle it out to anybody who's willing to buy it. And it's there's almost no gold documented being exported from the Eastern Congo because it's almost all smuggled. So would a fair trade kind of scheme for gold in the Congo work? That's the goal, I think, of these kind of certification initiatives. The problem is that as a substance, as a resource, it is just much more challenging to do that with gold than it is to do with tin, tungsten, wolframite, which are the other big minerals in the Eastern Congo.
Sure. Moving back to the political level, this year is obviously dominated by the upcoming elections. Do you think that the a new set of elections are likely to improve the security situation for people in East DRC?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, the president, Joseph Kabila, is trying to prove that he has been able to consolidate peace in the Congo. The election slogan for his election in 2006 was the bringer of peace, that he was the person who had brought peace to the Congo because he had presided over this transition that had brought all the belligerents together in a transitional government. Now, unfortunately for him, after the 2006 elections, where he was voted in as or confirmed as president, the security situation in the Eastern Congo deteriorated drastically. And therefore, his reputation as a peacemaker is seriously damaged. He's been trying to improve that over the last 4 or 5 months by striking deals with remaining armed groups in the Eastern Congo, bringing them in to the national government. But these are so I guess you could say because of that, security situation in the very short term may improve a little bit because he's eager to show that security has gotten better in the East. But, you know, unfortunately, these deals, because they're basically just co-option of these armed groups, buying them off, giving them money, and they don't address the root causes of the conflict. They don't address the root grievances of these armed groups. They're likely to be very tenuous and not to hold for very long. On the other hand, none of the main political contenders in the elections, so there's President Kabila, who's the incumbent, there's Etienne Tshisekedi, who is the veteran opposition candidate, who has been the main opposition since Mobutu's time, and then there's Vital Kamerhe, who used to be in Kabila's camp, who defected. So those are the three main candidates as they are at the moment. And of the opposition candidates, none of them have strong links to armed groups. So one could say that if Kabila wins, he's favored to win, that as frustrated that the opposition may be, they won't have armed groups to go back to rebel, to protest the outcome of the elections. So I guess all of that is to say that the elections are not likely to have an enormous impact on the security situation in the Eastern Congo, because none of the armed groups in the Eastern Congo are known to have large stakes in these elections. Now, on the other hand, they're not likely to improve the situation very much either, in the sense that one of the main problem, I think, as many people see in the Eastern Congo, is one of institutional and state capacity. The reason the Congolese government has been reduced to continuously bargaining with its opponents, its rivals, these several dozen armed groups that persist in the Eastern Congo, is because its own army is very weak. And in the absence of a stick, the only thing they have to offer these armed groups are carrots. So armed rebellion in the Eastern Congo has been something that's become something of a business. You start an armed group, you get bought off, you become integrated. If the integration doesn't work too well, you go back, you start another armed group, you get bought off again. And that has been going on now for at least since 2003 or 4. And demobilization programs become somewhat something of revolving doors. And as long as you have a weak central government, a weak army, and a weak police, it's difficult to see how that's going to change, particularly with the rampant unemployment in the Eastern Congo, particularly with many local grievances over identity, over lands, and the lack of the capacity of the central government to guarantee the assets of important business constituencies in the Eastern Congo. And therefore, those constituencies feel that it's necessary to maintain armed groups, protect whatever assets they may have, be they political, security, or economic assets. So for all of those reasons, the elections is not going to create strong institutions. I don't think they're going to have a big impact on the security situation in the Eastern Congo. I do think that in the very long term, the only way of creating strong institutions is along the democratic path. But that's going to require several elections. That's going to require 10 to 20 years to create a more functional army and more functional police.
So unfortunately, in the short term, you don't see a major change as a result of the election.
Well, what's happened? I mean, I think just to add to that, it's important to realize that there are two major changes that have taken place. So while there is the persistence of armed groups in the Eastern Congo, in particular Congolese armed groups, and this dynamic that I was describing as a revolving door for demobilization programs and so on, there have been two major trends that may bring more stability to the Eastern Congo. One is a peace deal that President Kabila struck with his Rwandan counterpart in 2009. And that led to the integration of the largest armed group in the Kivus, which was the CNDP of General Laurent Nkunda. It led to the arrest first of Nkunda, and then to the integration, or the quasi-integration, of his armed group into the Congolese army. And that peace deal is very significant because this rift between Congo and Rwanda has been, I guess what you could say, the dominating divide in the Congolese conflict. Rwanda versus Congo has been the divide along which most fighting has taken place over the last 5 or 6 years, one could say, in the Eastern Congo. So the fact that they did broker a peace deal and that the relations between them have been stable and relatively good over the last 2 years is a positive sign. Although I certainly would say that the terms of the deal and integration of the CNDP is still very tenuous and volatile. But that's a positive step, and that may bring greater stability in the short term, at least. The other thing that may bring greater stability that's not linked to elections is the fact that after the integration of the CNDP, the Congolese army, together with the CNDP, has been launching an armed offensive against the main Rwandan rebel group in the Eastern Congo, a group that's been there since the genocide in 1994 in Rwanda. And indeed, some of the officers of this armed group probably participated in the genocide in 1994. And the FDLR, which is the name of this armed group, was just 2 or 3 years ago, was thought to be between 6,000 and 7,000 strong. The offensive by the Congolese government, together with the Rwandan government and the CNDP against the FDLR, has had a serious impact on the FDLR, They've lost anywhere between 30 and 50% of their strength, either through casualties, defections, or desertions. And they're no longer nearly as strong a fighting force as they will be. And I think that over the next 10 years, probably, the FDLR will crumble, largely disappear in much of the region, and no longer be a strong force. And that's very important because the FDLR is one of the most abusive armed forces in the Eastern Congo. So those are two trends that are not linked to the elections, but that have brought at least a modicum or promise of modicum of stability, perhaps in the long term. Although I must say that the offensives against the FDLR when they first started in 2009 themselves were the cause of immense humanitarian suffering and displacement. But it looks like that at the same time they've led to the incapacitation of that particular armed group.
Continuing on the topic of peace in the longer term, I think one of the themes of your book is the lack of justice. And so you visit villages where victims remain in unmarked graves. And then at the political level, you also describe impunity as almost like a glue which holds together or held together the peace agreement between the different political groupings. Do you think that the inability or the refusal to find justice for the victims of the conflict in the Congo, might threaten peace in the longer term?
Well, at the end of the day, we just don't know. There has been, and because we don't know, my position has been that we should take the morally correct position, which is to try to push for as much justice as possible. Because, you know, whether I don't think impunity is impunity, there's no good record in the Congo of impunity bringing justice or more stability. Now, to preface that, I would say that since the beginning of the peace process in 1999 in the Congo, and certainly since the beginning of the transitional government in 2003, the position of the Congolese government, as well as almost all of the international actors in the peace process, has been to privilege stability over accountability, or as they would put it, peace over justice. And the reckoning has been that because so many of the members of the transitional government themselves were complicit in abuses or human rights violations, that if you adopt a maximalist position that everybody who committed a human rights violation should be tried, then that transitional agreement would fall apart. So because of that, almost there has been no truth and there's been no real Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There have been no prosecutions at all for any of the abuses committed during the war. And as a result, the Congolese government, the Congolese army, the Congolese police force is, I wouldn't say full of, but there are many people within those bodies who have serious records of human rights abuses. And there is very little deterrent for those people to continue violating human rights. And there has been no justice for many of the people of the Congo who have been aggrieved or whose rights have been violated. Now, I would say that in polling that's been done in the Congo, the Congolese people, although I think about 70 or 80% of Congolese people in the polling usually indicate that they do want justice. Justice is far down on the list of their demands and much higher on the list of their demands are things like development, education, food, healthcare. But when posed the question to Congolese, at least in surveys, whether they would prefer impunity or accountability, I think most, and explained that accountability could lead to destabilization, most Congolese have come out in favor of some sort of accountability. So it's difficult, there is no calculus. There's no easy calculus of justice. There's no easy argument that by prosecuting people, you automatically create a safer, more stable place. In fact, it's almost impossible to make that sort of argument because we just don't know what would happen. Probably, most likely, what happened in the short term is you probably would create more instability. In the long term, you may create a deterrent. You may create a society based more on the rule of law. And you may reinforce these fledgling Congolese institutions. But those are all maybes. But the converse is also true. The argument that impunity, or as they say, privileging stability, is, and forgiveness is, will somehow bring about stability has also not been proven true. You've had since the peace deal, the peace talks began in 2000, and, or the peace deal began, I could say, in 2003, there has been nothing but impunity, nothing but a lack of accountability, and we've had nothing but escalation of violence and continuation of conflicts. So I think that the arguments on both sides of that are just mired in uncertainty. We just don't know. And because it's mired in uncertainty, I think we need to take the morally responsible position, which is that where within the realm of the responsible we can promote accountability and justice, we should do so. That doesn't mean that we should prosecute each and every single person guilty of human rights abuses, but it does mean that we need to think more about it. And there has been very, very little thinking done. So things like vetting of police and army that's taken place in many post-conflict countries, where you give administrative sanctions to people who have been complicit in human rights violations, that hasn't happened in the Congo. A real Truth and Reconciliation Commission has not happened. Indeed, it's as if the door to history had been closed at the end of the conflict and people have just not spoken about it again, which is, and you mentioned in my book, I went to these villages across the Congo, villages whose names are famous or notorious in across the Congo for having been the sites of huge massacres. I visited the Kasika village where over 1,000 people were killed in 1998. And even though all of the Congo knows the name of Kasika, almost nothing has been done there. There's not even marked graves for the people who were killed. They were literally thrown in ditches on the side of the road and covered with dirt. And they're now overgrown with vines and shrubs. So it's just to say that almost nothing has been done. I think that instead of getting engaged in a relatively simplistic dialogue of peace versus justice, there's a much more constructive middle ground to be found, and a lot more can be done where you don't press for the maximalist position of the prosecution of every single human rights violator, but you do try to work towards justice and work towards the creation of a rule of law, so that not only can the victims have their day in court and they can receive justice, but you have deterrence for further abuses.
Jason, I understand that your connection with DRC actually started working for a local human rights organization in South Kivu. I wonder if you could describe the role that local organizations have played in working for peace in DRC.
Sure. The role of local organizations, particularly in the eastern DRC, but also, I guess, throughout the country, has a history in the collapse of the Congolese state. Under dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, who ruled the Congo for 32 years, the state ceased in many areas to provide basic services and functions. And into this vacuum of state power often stepped local organizations, civil society organizations, ranging from the Catholic Church to human rights groups, to women's rights groups, to cooperatives. And they then began carrying out many of the functions of the state, either being with help from international donors that became much more abundant in the 1990s in particular. Some organizations also had for-profit sort of platforms, whether they were microcredit organizations or simple schools where you'd pay school fees in order to receive an education. Or organizations like the Catholic Church had substantial resources themselves that they could maintain hospitals and schools with. And those organizations then became incredibly important during the war. When I first traveled to the Eastern Congo in 2001, I worked for a local human rights group called Héritiers de la Justice, based in Bukavu. These organizations were the eyes and ears of the international community, of everybody outside of the Congo, to know what was going on. We would not have been able to find out about many of the human rights violations. We would not have been able to understand what was going on without many of these human rights organizations and other organizations on the ground. But I think more important than that, leaving aside even the international community and what we know and didn't know, is that these people provided also support and protection to vulnerable people on the ground. They provided a safety network and made it difficult to or providing useful protection, I would say, to the local population. So then in the town of Bukavu, where I used to live, a town of 500,000 people in South Kivu, the occupying force, that was a very brutal and repressive occupying rebel force, the RCD, had actually a hard time being too abusive in Bukavu itself, because there was so much resistance kicked up by the local population organized around these civil society organizations. They would mount protests in the streets, they would hold vigils, they would shut down the business districts in Bukavu in protest, they would lobby the local governor, they would lobby the military. And that was, I think, incredibly important during the war, sort of a bulwark against repression and abuse.
There still is a large number of local organizations operating in East DRC. Do you think that enhancing their role might increase the likelihood of a sustainable peace in the region?
There are an enormous number of NGOs in the Eastern Congo, some good, some not so good. Some of them, I think, can play an important role. Now, the reason I hesitate a little bit is because the civil society is such a multifarious creature in the Eastern Congo. There's so many different aspects and dynamics to it, and civil society has become increasingly politicized as well since the peace deal. There has been many prominent actors in civil society have left to become a part of a political party or the other. And others who remain in civil society are known to have particular bias for one side or the other. Now, that's probably the case the world around, so that's nothing particular to the Congo. You could certainly say that, you know, the Center for American Progress in the United States has a particular political bias. So that's nothing particular to the Congo. But it does, I think it's an important caveat to understanding that local organizations are not divorced from local politics. They are part and parcel of local politics. And indeed, if they weren't, they probably wouldn't be much less useful. But it's also important to understand that, to understand the limitations as well as civil society. Now, having said that, I think in particular as the UN peacekeeping mission begins to withdraw, as will be the case over the next couple of years, as the Congolese government itself becomes, or as the Congolese people become more accustomed to the fact that they have an elected government at the national as well as the local level that they have a right to hold to account, that these civil society organizations, hopefully at least, can play a very, very important role in demanding accountability from the various sectors of Congolese society, particularly the government and the security services. In the past, a big burden of that has fallen on international NGOs and international community. But I think what you can sort of see in the Congolese, the change in Congolese civil society, whereas during the war, when I used to work in Congolese civil society in 2001, our focus was really pointed towards the international community. If there was a human rights violation, we would call Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch or embassies and complain. Now, the focus is slowly shifting, as it should be, to the Congolese government. If there's a human rights violation, the first person who's responsible, who should be alerted to this, and who should be lobbied, is the Congolese government itself. So I think that change is slowly taking place, and I think that can be a valuable change. I think that some parts of Congolese civil society will be helpful in creating a more transparent and accountable Congolese government and security services. I am worried, however, though, that in elsewhere civil society can also be undermined, both by the wrong kind of international engagement, but also by the politicization of civil society by local actors.
Okay, Jason, thank you very, very much for your time and for telling us about the latest developments with the conflict in DRC. Thank you.
Thank you.